thank you. I don't know if I deserve it. As Bjorn said, after that introduction, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. And actually, I'm not going to say anything. I was wheeled in as chair yesterday, I think. The stars are Kevin McFadyen and David Morgan. David Morgan's idea, I think, originally to have a session on psychoanalysis and politics. Goodness, we need some help in sorting out politics, don't we? Can psychoanalysis? There's a big question. This evening is about whistleblowing, and one of the really difficult things, way back, I think as one of these comments said, way back to the Nuremberg trials, if not before, there has been a debate about the place of conforming to your organisation or country, or blowing the gaff, whistleblowing. Okay, that's what we're going to try to think about, I guess. It is not just the politics of it, but some possible unconscious dimensions to this kind of phenomenon. I'll introduce Gavin McFadyen very briefly. He's probably very well known to many of you as a journalist.
I doubt it.
Well, now you're well known in this
hall. Your cover's blown. Yeah.
Yes. Particularly World in Action, and is subsequently a professor at City University running the Centre for Investigative Journalists. So really a very important position for trying to expose the truth about things that are not truly told. I'll ask Gavin to set us off with the first talk.
Okay. In fact, I'll jump over to this diagram here.
Do you want to bring him around the front? You're okay.
No, it's okay. As long as you can hear me in the back. Can you hear all right?
A bit more up.
Is that better? More. Can you get more? Okay. I was asked to speak a bit about the social political consequences of dissent. Dissent in the form of people who stood up in their workplace and exposed things they thought were wrong. Morally wrong, ethically wrong, physically wrong, socially wrong. And it made me think a lot about what is involved in standing up, because it's so much a function less of the whistleblower often than the social circumstances which generated the whistleblower in the first place, and in the environment in which the whistleblower finds he has to find conflict, or finds his own conflict in it. So there's a functional relationship between social institutions and dissent, and we're immersed in that as investigative reporters, and as active supporters of whistleblowing as we possibly can be. Because as investigative journalists, I should say, we are entirely dependent on the magnanimity and the courage of people who have a great deal to lose by standing up and talking about things that will cost them a great deal. And in fact, half of the stories that you read that expose huge crimes and wrongdoing are the result of whistleblowers, the result of their courage. And so I have to even start by saluting that in every way I can, because without them, half of the investigative reporting that we know about, in terms of corruption, malfeasance, ghastly injustice, mass murder, and all the rest, has come from whistleblowers. To them, investigative reporters owe a great deal. And one of the reasons we got involved in helping to support and found the WBUK, which is the whistleblowers organization, was because, sadly, there was no such organization in this country. There was no organization that was devoted entirely to defending and supporting those who risked so much for the public purse, as it were, the public good. And we thought that was wrong and should be addressed. That's what we've done, and what we're talking about partly tonight. The functional relationship between social institutions and dissent is a very complex one, and it's an historical one, and I would propose to discuss a number of things which will be known to many of you, and I hope I don't bore you to death with it, because I thought it was probably useful to go back into the last 100 years to see what the precedents were for this kind of discovery and what sort of circumstances it was germinated in. How was the act of individual courage in this way incubated? In what was it incubated? Because it comes in waves. It's not an individual here, an individual there. It actually comes in great cycles. And so I propose to discuss that a bit by going over a history that I'm afraid some of you may well know very well, and to take a look at the evolution and what it means. Most of you, I suspect, will know some of this. But most of the consequences of political dissent are troubling, often fearful, onerous, and rarely happy. Whistleblowers are an expression of dissent and are largely the act of courageous individuals who object to what they experience as corruption, malfeasance, brutality, and injustice. In the 19th century, dissent could be acceptable as mischief, as tweaking the nose of the bourgeoisie. And often at dinner parties, it was perfectly acceptable to say outrageous things that might later be described as whistleblowing. But that was true only as long as the disclosures and the fundamental attacks on the social system itself were not the center plank of the dissent. If they were small utopian criticisms or otherwise, they were acceptable. But as we're all aware, by 1885, dissent had become ideological in large parts of Europe, and indeed the formation of large-scale mass movements characterized dissent in a large and effective institutional way. That's all been, of course, destroyed, and we'll talk about that and what its consequences are. But it took, in most developed economies, with it, a sort of free press. What accompanied dissenting views was the idea that they could have some physical expression in newsprint. And there was a very aggressive and vigorous democratic press in Europe, in large parts of Europe and the United States, which allowed that to happen. And that's, again, what we don't have that now. But we certainly had it then. And even in the most radical expression of dissent in the 1890s, for example, of an anti-clerical variety, for example, an anti-capitalist currency, those things were very widespread. They formed 50, 75, 100, 200 newspapers would print this stuff all across Europe. There was even in Oklahoma City and the most rural parts of the United States staggeringly radical little magazines called Appeal to Reason, which represented that sort of disclosure. When Ida Tarbell, a woman investigator at the New York Times, disclosed what Standard Oil was doing in its monopoly form in the United States, she was pilloried and subjected to huge attacks, but the New York Times nonetheless published what she did. That's not true anymore, as we'll discuss. So it's a significant change from the rather vigorous democratic processes which, in a sense, we kind of grew up with the idea of, to what we now have. It's often said that in most of the developed European and American parliaments, social democrats, Christian democrats, Republicans, monarchists jostled and elbowed their way into political life, often employing the press to its purposes. By the end of the First World War, however, communist parties had emerged and were doing all sorts of strong things and causing even more arguments and all the rest of it. And with the revolutions underway in 12 countries in Europe in that same period, which we often have forgotten, which were the physical expression of a lot of that dissent. Within a few years of that, fascists and the Nazis were able to organize a huge authoritarian movement to defeat them. It's financed by the largest business powers of the day. And this, in effect, was their conscious attempt to find an armed counterattack to what they regarded, in close quotes, as the underclass and their intellectual pygmies, who were supporting them. So all of this is widely known, well documented, and still debated. We now live, however, as you all know, in a rather different world. And this is different in its political complexion, its view of itself, and the political anxieties at its center, and the curious absence, which unites most of these currents now, of no vision of the future whatsoever. What is unique about the political world we live in is that there's never a discussion now about anything in the future. Most people spend their time looking in the rearview mirror, and that often, in one form or another, informs our political debate. We could even say that we no longer thrive and argue with contending visions of the future because nobody's interested in the future, at least in the establishment. And this causes an extraordinary problem. It means that the dreams which motivate people have no place. The idea that things could be better, things could be more exciting, things in terms of developing human potential could have some commanding place in that is not part of the debate anymore. And all the controlling media reflect one version or another of these dominant ideas, most of which, by the way, are those of corporations and their leaders and their state spokesmen. And this has provoked a kind of creeping authoritarianism, which we describe in the United States and here as effectively a kind of one-state, one-party state character. There is no difference between most of the political parties and most of the large developing countries. The reason I'm going on about this is only because it informs what individuals do. If you don't have a political party to protect you, if you don't have a berm separating you from authoritarians, fascists, Nazis, and all the rest, we don't have that anymore. So you're pretty much, if you're a dissident, a whistleblower, pretty much on your own. So which is why we felt it was necessary to try and organize something in their defense. But it means that the culture and character of political opposition has changed quite radically. Now, who will protect you if you don't have these institutions that we're used to? Social democracy, trade union, intellectual organizations of all kinds, all the things we're used to. And we had them 30 years ago, but they're no longer homes for different views. If you have serious views about what you want to do in society for yourself, or if seriously strong ethical considerations, to whom can you express them? Because if you go out into the public area to express them, you can be at considerable risk. Most whistleblowers, as we know, and you'll no doubt hear about in detail, pay a huge personal price for what they've done, something which makes me extremely angry. The idea that if you stand up and speak out against this sort of thing, people will attack you, you'll be victimized and turned into some kind of villain, you'll be subjected to vast bureaucratic nonsense, your historical records of employment will be changed. Often, in fact, we discovered most people lose their spouses who do this. The spouses didn't sign up for it. They didn't sign up for all the program and difficulty that accompanies anybody who stands up and has the courage to do it. So, in a way, it's a function of the lack of social democratic protection, if you will, that we don't have that anymore. We have, in fact, almost no social protection. As a television producer, we did strong programs in World in Action and Panorama, where I was, because we had the protection not only of a sympathetic management in some parts, but we also had a trade union, so that we all felt some basic sense of security. We don't have that anymore. None at all. None at all. Wages have fallen. I made more as a truck driver, as a child in the States, than I made as a television producer in England. And that's literally true. So it's a function of the problem we all had. So we have a situation where, in its more specific terms, compared to 30 years ago, there was no opposition newspapers, and multi-channel television operates in a closed, with a, generally, with some important exceptions, but with a closed government agenda. What emerges is sustained and filtered news, but where there is no apparent censorship and no blank pages. Where, for a journalist, access, or what his editor likes to think of as access, becomes more important than the truth of the story. So unless you get access to something which is controlled by other people, they won't be interested in your story. We confront this every day. So it's a particular sort of problem. Between 50% and 70% of what you read in the newspapers and on television, as most of you will know, it comes from the wire services. It comes from abstract news providers. The actual reporters in the newspaper have very little to do with it, except to write the opening paragraph and the concluding paragraph. Think of it the House style. Otherwise, it's PAP that's produced on an industrial assembly line, and which is very rarely subjected to the scrutiny that we would expect all news to be subjected to. So, which means you get a diet, in effect, which has been pre-selected for you by the corporate predilections of those who actually own the large corporate entities that supply the news. Now, in this environment, we're talking about whistleblowers. It's this environment that whistleblowers have to work in, and that their journalistic sympathizers have to struggle in. So between the fact that the news machinery has now been taken over by giant corporations, or even in the BBC, which is very sympathetic to those corporations, you have huge PR machines, which have now invaded the space as well. and set their agendas going. You can't speak to, for example, a leading politician. You can't speak to a sports person. You can't speak to anybody, in close quotes, of importance, unless the PR person agrees to that interview. And what's, of course, distressing in that circumstance is that they control the, therefore, the agenda. They will say, well, what questions are you going to ask? And how are you going to ask? And if they think there's something hostile or not beneficial for them, you don't get the interview. Which means that you, as a reporter, have to go back to your manager and say, they won't give me the interview. The editor says you're fired. So it's a difficult place for people to be in. But that's how they do it. For example, you'll never see an interview with any leading sports figure in Britain, not one, which hasn't been approved by some PR person. And all your questions vetted. And if you make reference to that, you'll never get another interview. That's how it works. So whistleblowers, again, come about because they're having to function in an environment like this. And I'm not surprised that there are more whistleblowers now than there have been in a long time. Because we're living in a world where these incredible corporate controls are really strangling what you would want to read in any normal way. They don't want you to have that. Not because they're politically hostile to it, though many are. The reason is because it doesn't make money. And unless it makes money, it's of no interest to them whatsoever. So we begin to notice, for example, all the controls that go on. Tell me if I'm going on too long. But this way, if the controls are serious, which they now are in many ways, it's kind of an index that they're concerned of the failure of that policy. There are now, I think the figure I had last night was 147 million closed-circuit television cameras in London. There are almost as many closed-circuit television cameras in London as there are in the United States. So when you think of it in those terms, you're thinking of a society which is very paranoid in its core about all of you and about all of us. Very worried about what you think and all the rest of it. Now, if you include in that strange painting the thousands of new community police support officers, the militarization of the police, and this was described to me recently by a member of the SAS as being the strangest thing. He said, we thought we had special weapons until we saw the police. I thought, that's genuinely amazing. The secret police now in Britain, as in most countries, are literally marrying into activist circles, environmental activists and all the rest, and even fathering children with them. These are disclosures of an astonishing kind. We've never had them before, and they come from the police themselves. And what's interesting is it's the police who gave them to us. It's whistleblowers in the police who came out and are making that possible for us to know. We've never done anything like this ever in the past. The current wave of disclosures, I think you could reasonably say, were inspired by WikiLeaks. Because we didn't have any of this until Assange and his friends opened the door. And suddenly, it was now possible to expose big secrets in a huge way. And that's what we're seeing. And we've just seen the beginning of it. And Mr. Snowden, who has no particular relation to Julian Assange, other than in the same general world, was clearly inspired in a lot of important ways by what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks had done. And there's a lot more of that coming. I mentioned to myself here before I came in that, hold on, this microphone just fell off. Pretty great. I don't know what we'll do with it. But okay, can you organize that? Until the massacres in Iraq, for Iraqi civilians, and the mass torture camps in Iraq and Afghanistan were exposed by WikiLeaks, these crimes had been hidden. Very few people knew about them, and all the rest. When Seymour Hersh disclosed the monstrous assassinations that occurred in Vietnam in the 60s, leading to My Lai, it was all denied. It was all said to be lies and communist propaganda and all the rest of it. It turned out to be much worse than even he thought. He won the Pulitzer Prize for it, but was, of course, never invited to the White House to be awarded for having embarrassed them, just like Julian Assange and Snowden and all the rest of them do. It became, I think, in that period, particularly the Assange period, one of the things that he brought out was a huge swath of documents from the State Department. And these widely reported in The Guardian for a while. And they led to some extraordinary disclosures about bribery and cronyism and corruption on a vast scale. Assange thought that they were trying to put numbers to this, and they staggered around $3 billion a month in bribes alone were being organized through U.S. embassies abroad to secure commercial contracts for American companies. Now, that would be a scandal of enormous proportions in any society under any circumstances. But the only way we ever found out about any of that, given the corporate control of so much of the media and all the rest of it, is through WikiLeaks and through whistleblowers. And there are more following. It's not the end of it by any means. It became impossible to deny the truth of the documents that WikiLeaks put out. But instead, of course, what happened was that the media then launched, with the government, a huge attack on the messengers. So Assange became now a state enemy. Snowden will become a state enemy, and is becoming. Bradley Manning is in prison. All these people are paying a huge price for having stood up and exposed what they've exposed. Assange, I've just made a little list here this morning, he was characterized as a crazed egotist, potential cult leader, rapist, a model of bad bodily hygiene, a narcissist with an unpleasant dress sense, and a man we wouldn't complain if he ended up in an orange jumpsuit. That was just 1 week's comment on Julian Assange of a certain kind. So if Assange opened the door to a young whistleblower, who was himself then denounced by the media, Bradley Manning was described, I think, as a troubled young man from a broken home, uncertain of his sexual identity, disliking many of his gung-ho military colleagues and workmates, and the fact that he had a huge dislike from the military and what they stood for was never mentioned. It is now, but it wasn't mentioned for about a year. Nobody said that he was anything other than a troubled guy who wasn't certain of what sex he was or whatever. So anyway, but in all of this, these are the prices I think that people pay. They paid some extreme ones. I don't think anybody in Britain has paid prices quite as high as these guys, though we hope that perhaps some will come forward to do that. So, but I'll conclude in no sense by saying that that opened the door further to the Snowden, Drake, Binney disclosures, which are probably the most shocking disclosures that any of us in journalism have seen in my 35 years as an investigative reporter. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we now know the extent to which surveillance exists in Britain and the United States. There's two leading proponents of that idea. As part of a program that, by the way, started many years ago called Total Information Awareness, TIA, under Cheney and Wolfowitz, which was the secret progenitor of PRISM, which is the system that investigates all of you. Everything you've ever written, looked at, inquired about on the Internet, everything, every text, every bit of data you pull down, all of it is known. Everything. I mean, it's really scary. And at first, if you'd said this a few years ago, it was up to your paranoia. Couldn't possibly be true. Well, we now know that we didn't understand half of it.
You're right to be paranoid.
That's right. That's right. But I mean, it's really quite astonishing. And they had this information against what they said initially. They've had it now for 7 years, maybe even longer. In other words, they've been scooping up and putting into huge memory banks in Utah and other places everything that you've ever done. Everything. Which means the possibilities for blackmail, political coercion, all kinds of things are imminent. They're just a possibility that can be exploited at any time they want to do it. And you're talking about a society in the United States, for example, in which you have 1 million people with top secret clearance. And the idea, of course, that a Bradley Manning or a Snowden has betrayed American soldiers and have blood on his hands is ludicrous as it sounds. Because if every foreign power realized that you could get a top secret clearance by joining some private contractor, they've already been there. There's no way they wouldn't have done it. They're not stupid. So the idea that there's some particular political agenda of Snowden or anybody else to discourage is crazy. So anyway, I mention all that because the FBI has now come out. There are two people in the FBI, two in the CIA who come out to support Drake and Binney and Snowden, all saying the same thing. And what that really means, then, is that it's now an open game. Everybody now knows they can't deny what's actually happened, which is the spying on all of you and all of us and everybody else will have a huge consequence, for example, on the work I do, because I can no longer protect sources. It was bad enough protecting sources before. You know, you go for a walk in the park. Now, we're not even certain we can do that anymore. I mean, it's You have to have a very strange agenda to want to do this stuff, but that's how bad it is. So the consequences of these things have profoundly altered what most of us think of as our professional obligations, our ethical obligations. We can't function the way we ever did before, and nobody knows quite how to do that. I want to encourage all of you, if you are interested in it, to learn how to protect your computers, learn Tor and encryption and all the other things that journalists are now learning, and we're training journalists to do it, to protect yourselves and your friends and your family. Because there's no way they don't know all this already. Why give them any help?
And patience.
And patience. And patience, yeah. I mean, Drake, who's a very sympathetic, nice guy, senior official in the NSA, said his last comment to journalists were, he said, encrypt the crap out of everything. Give them a hard time. And with that, I'll...
Well, we...
Hello.
This is a joyous start to the evening. But it is very serious stuff, isn't it? Again, I want to move straight on then to David Morgan, who is a member of the Psychoanalytical Society in Britain, works as a consultant in the health service at the Portman Clinic, now in full-time in private practice. And will explain all this psychoanalytic.
No, it was just thrown out for debate, I think.
Yes.
And this is called First They Came. First They Came is a famous statement and provocative poem attributed to Pastor Martin Neumüller about the sloth of German intellectuals following the Nazis' rise to power and the subsequent purging of their targets group after group. You probably know this, but it's worth repeating. First they came to the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came to the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Catholic. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. For many people, the miasma of fame that surrounds Assange and Edward Snowden, they seem to be rooted in their narcissism. However much they dress it up, their one day in the sun is seen quite possibly erroneously, in my opinion, as we'll be discussing later, as driven by self-interest. Films are made about famous whistleblowers, and they're placed as now as A-list celebrities, Erin Brockovich, a particular hero of mine, probably because you should have played mine, actually. Seems assured to us, gawping onlookers, that they're very interesting, that. Through their disclosing acts, they, rather than governments and leaders, become the important ones, it could seem to us. But for most of the people I've seen since Professor McFadyen asked me to become a consultant for the British whistleblowers, it's a very different story. Everyday whistleblowers, those whose name do not become a public entity, experience loss, not gain, through their decision to disclose. And whatever it is that they disclose in all the many fields these people emerge from, the whistleblowers that I have met are waiting to have or have had their pension rights, mortgages, and jobs rescinded. Their comfortable places of esteem in their communities are dismantled. And equally important, from a psychological point of view, they have lost their peace of mind and quite often their own faith in their own value and motives. I'm here tonight to discuss what motivates a whistleblower and look at the psychological profile of people who risk or gain, depending on where we stand, so much. Let's face it, whistleblowing as a term sounds vaguely pejorative, like snitch. So I favour the term now, social disclosure, because it gives the clue to what altruistically motivated disclosure is really about. In Germany, I discovered recently from a German friend of mine, there's no word for whistleblower at all. And they use a word that translates as traitor, which shows us how suspicious we are of people who break the rules. Traitor or whistleblower, narcissist or idealist. these are the poles of our discussion. We expect in Nazi Germany, Pinochet's Chile, or North Korea for there to be hideous consequences for any perceived betrayal. We know that terrorist states do all they can to stamp out any dissent, and we like the idea that different mores apply here, that we live in a land of freedom and protection for human rights. And in comparison with the totalitarian states I've mentioned, we do, of course, enjoy significant freedom. But what I have discovered is how tough and suspicious our societal attitudes are to people we perceive as different. Those who break free, not only from our public laws and standards, but who undermine all our cozy assumptions about the safety of our world and the security that we enjoy. When a whistle is blown, we all listen, and we have to decide, each and every one of us, how to react to the people who tell us things we may not want to know. Even in Britain, or especially in Britain, I don't know, criticism or threat to the social order is muted or seen as anti-authoritarian, naive, an attack on the parental authority, the status quo. Compliance, playing the game, and loyalty to one's organisation is often seen as a sign of psychological health. In my own professional institution, a criticism of the authority of some senior people is usually construed as trying to see into the parents' bedroom. Most of us in this institution are well over 50. I don't care anymore. What countless famous whistleblowers discover is that the same blocks of speaking about problems, betrayals, failures and exploitation apply here in Britain, just as in any totalitarian state, albeit much more subtly. We bring powerful pressures to bear on those who risk speaking out. I'm thinking of people I've spoken to in the last year. But last year I've seen about 50 people in this job. And I wasn't that paranoid to start with. The shipbuilder, this is slightly disguised, but the shipbuilder who discovers that his yard is being using seriously substandard material is in a position to create unemployment for himself and everyone he knows. The economic impact of a scandal to his company, already on the brink of economic collapse, would be disastrous. He's also aware that the lives of the product's users are seriously at risk. He goes to and is shunned by his union and his bosses, but he still speaks out. He receives death threats in the post and loses his job. His health begins to deteriorate. He's now accused of having mental health problems, which of course, now he does, and probably did before in a pre-morbid personality every day sort of way that most of us do. He goes to his MP and is told there is no evidence. The MP and local newspapers are funded by interested parties. The judicial person who discovers the conglomeration of Freemasons in a chosen profession and believes that they have operated a cover-up over a certain case and decides to tell the story. The banker who discovers in the house of Mammon all that matters is profit, by the surprise, and sees that as a consequence of dodgy auditing, his mother's pension company is eaten up by sharp practice. In the field of state provision, in hospitals and social services, even today when people speak out over damaging cuts or mismanagement or the appalling culture of uncare at Stafford Hospital or neglect in social care teams, they are still liable, despite Haringey and ADP, despite Bristol, they are still liable to be disbelieved, humiliated, and dismissed. As I listen to the many stories of painful internal conflict, fear and anger, and sometimes bitterness and regret, I think to myself, would I, an NHS worker for 25 years, without a financial cushion to fall back on in my private life, have stood up and been counted, risked my mortgage and children's futures? Would or did I put my own self-interest and survival above the altruism revealing neglect and incompetence? If I had been at the Bristol Children's Hospital or Haringey Social Services, would I have said anything in the interest of saving lives? I hope so, but I'm not sure. In terms of thinking about the psychological precursors and sequelae of the disclosures I have met as a psychoanalyst and psychologist, I ask myself, does idealism exist? Is disclosure just a narcissistic or an altruistic act? and does it matter if it's about the truth? I've now seen 50 disclosures, and it's a fascinating but paranoid-inducing job. The first comment from my first ever psychological meeting with an established and successful disclosure was, "Is this place my consulting room bugged?" Now, I'm used to working with psychosis, and I normally see mine and everybody else's, and I normally see this sort of fantasy as a projected form of aggression, externalized onto the outside world, where it then persecutively originates from outside in the minds of others, or through delusions and hallucinations. Through externalization, the internal aggressive impulses are thus reduced and put out to tender. But with this group, the feeling has remained for weeks, and the question, "Is my room bugged?" stays with me in a very real way, a bit like this room today. It no longer seems so delusional. I tell myself that I'm not that important, but the stories I hear are compelling and mostly feel genuine and feel really, really dangerous. The boats, I might say. Undoubtedly, many of the people I see do exist in paranoid states of mind. We all do. Some must surely have had traces of these states before they disclose. Afterwards, they feel watched. Their level of trust is low. And it's easy to write them all off as vexatious litigants and troublemakers, and a few are. Part of my job is to sort out the chaff from the wheat, as it were. A small minority may indeed be less than idealistically motivated, but even them, they may have something important to say. And like victims of abuse, it is essential you find ways to hear it. Traumatizing it is to hear, and seductive as it is to turn a blind eye, or just pathologize, the ultimate defense of the cushioned Hampstead psychoanalyst, I have to say. I have become convinced that the psychological profile of the whistleblower is not different from anybody in this room. I had to sort of work through that process, because one way I was defending myself was to find the fault in the messenger, to shoot the messenger. You know, of course I found things that are depressed, you know, when they were 12 or something. You know. And one was trying to make connection, but the reality was I was trying to avoid the terrible truth of what they were telling me about. My defences. Of course, not all whistleblowing is benign or altruistically motivated. Her Majesty's Revenue has an anonymous phone line, just in case you don't know, for people to report tax evasion. And it is apparently consistently used to denounce neighbours and family members. And professional colleagues who have a terrible library. While disclosure can be an altruistic act, it can all too easily be used for revenge and humiliation. At times, some whistleblowers I've seen are clearly eager to attack authorities through resentment. Stalled careers, failed love affairs, and no pay rise, as we all know, can see increases in some individual willingness to shame or punish their communities, employers, or families. So it does have a low upside. However, the organisation as institution seems at times dedicated, in my view now, to the destruction of the moral individualist. Frequently organisations actually succeed, which means that whistleblowers I've seen are broken, unable to reconcile their actions and beliefs with the responses they receive from others. Understandably, many people who disclose accept some reward, praise and respect. Almost always they have to face disappointment. You don't want to know. You really do not want to know. In order to make sense of their stories, some whistleblowers may set aside the things they've always believed. The truth is larger than the herd instinct. It isn't. That someone in charge will do the right thing. That the family is a haven from a heartless world. Any old psychoanalyst will tell you that we project onto external authorities our internal versions of parental figures. When those parental figures are benign and fair-minded, the failure of external authorities to live up to the projection can be devastating. Many whistleblowers recover from their experience, even if they live in a world very different from the one they now live in, the world very different from the one they knew before their confrontation with the organisation. Some people I've worked with have had to leave their countries and start anew. One aspect of social disclosure that is underestimated is the emotional fallout that is occasioned by revealing truths that other people prefer to keep hidden, shooting the messenger. Sometimes, literally. I have this, put a bit of paranoia into my I have really thought seriously about David Kelly as a victim these days. Just throw that out there. David Kelly as a victim these days, do you? Disclosers of uncomfortable truths can become the recipient of a great deal of hostility from a variety of quarters, like my countertransference to the people I talk to. I wanted to pathologize them, but they were making me feel insecure. They also made me feel dishonest, because how many times have I turned a blind eye to things in the NHS, the ECT I participated in psychiatry, and all this little stuff. Like a psychoanalyst, this is how I painted myself, disclosers threaten to make something conscious and known that has either been hidden or brushed under the carpet through a range of people turning a blind eye. There are powerful forces range against the discloser in order to maintain the status quo, the equilibrium we all need. And disclosures threaten whatever defences and belief systems institutions have developed to permit the behaviour that is being exposed. Revelations can be experienced by the institution and colleagues as humiliating and attacking. And others will see themselves as justified in retaliating against a whistleblower, and there is often a concerted attempt to discredit or pathologise them. It's a reversal of projective identification. Somebody puts something unpleasant into you, what you've got to do is get it back, evacuate it to them as soon as possible. Having an understanding of the group hostility to revelations that are threatening to cohesion can be of considerable use to an individual who needs to find a way to maintain their self-belief at times of personal stress and marginalisation, shorting out in therapy basically what's them and what isn't. Part of this, in my experience, is getting help to understand the unconscious reasons for putting themselves in this situation in the first place. And that takes us to the heart of individual psychology, personal experience and unconscious motivation. Any previous emotional and psychological difficulty will be exacerbated, or if not evident before, brought to the surface. I've seen people who've had occupational health psychiatrists employed by the organisation they're working for give them an assessment, clearly to find pathological reasons for their whistleblowing. It happens a lot. Hey, people being paid by the state, really, to pathologise the whistleblower. Motives and personal integrity will be publicly questioned so that through reversal and projection, the institution that is being questioned can evade any sense of responsibility for wrongdoing. The discloser is therefore made to feel the wrongdoer, arousing serious self-doubt and depression, sometimes suicidal feelings. I've realised from meeting with my patients that we all employ, all of us, what George Orwell in 1984 called double think. And Orwell comes to mind all the time when I'm seeing these patients. The psychological phenomenon behind it is called doubling. E.g., you're a middle-level functionary in a bureaucracy or corporation, and you possess some truth you know does not conform to your institution or boss's agenda. Doubling, splitting, as I would call it, as a psychoanalyst, means you can hold true to your personal morality while maintaining a separate public or institutional morality. At home, you may never think to withhold truths from your family. On the job, telling the truth may hurt not only your boss, but your institution, your livelihood, and the health and safety of your family. In such situations, it is helpful to be able to hold contradictory positions to separate your different selves different loyalty structures, so different cells for different jobs. But why do whistleblowers do it? First of all, I think, as Hannah Arendt has said, actually, a great whistleblower herself, somebody who saw the rise of Nazism in Germany, they don't manage to double or split themselves. For them, the inherent contradiction would be too great and too painful. They may fit, and I think most of them do, with Hannah Arendt's idea of the heroic. Men and women, people who talk seriously with themselves about what they're doing, people who cannot double or do double speak. They feel a compulsion to do the right thing. As one patient last week said to me, I had to do it. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't speak up. They can't not choose to abide by their conscience. The trouble is, blowing the whistle separates whistleblowers from their former lives. Organisations constrained by law not to fire or retaliate against whistleblowers find a very subtle way of doing it. E.g., Assange is currently resident in a small office in the embassy of a South American state in London, although a rather radical friend of mine said a perfect place for a CIA agent. You see what happens, it gets very confusing otherwise. And the nuclear scientist I saw after whistleblowing about security risks find herself assigned to making copies or emptying waste paper baskets. For the first time, her reports are negative, and she's passed over for her long-awaited promotion. We are never going to be able to decipher in full the unconscious and conscious motives of those who disclose. The reality is, I'm not sure we need to. We can argue for as long as we like about the personal stories and pathologies of our most famous whistleblowers, Edward Snowden and Assange, or anybody we see. I could write case histories filled with the early experiences that motivate later acts of brave or foolhardy or vicious disclosure. But perhaps the most important thing that we have to keep in mind is that societies who cannot tolerate disclosure and transparency are on their way to becoming the totalitarian states that most of us in this room abhor. Whistleblowers act as a conscience for us all.
Thank you. Ivan tells me we should finish by 8:30 sharpish, right? So that gives us about 40 minutes to try to digest some of this, these talks, which I guess haven't been very easy to listen to. So we may want a few minutes to digest it before we can think of comments to make. So perhaps, are there any specific sort of factual questions that anybody wants to ask Gavin or David? There are people full of thought.
It's not very factual. Pedro, because I just returned to NHS for a couple of months ago. Nothing has changed since 2004, but I worked there. And also in Denmark and other countries, I've worked in various NHS and private and whatever. So I try to maintain what I learned in medical school, but it works, just do the right thing, and it's very difficult. Yes, it is, but it's doable with a zigzag career and all that. What I want to ask is, we are talking about the health of whistleblower, and we need to build a discipline and muscle to resilient. But would you recommend anyone to be courageous, or are there people who we should protect from being the whistleblower and saying, no, you will break down? So is it like a sport that you need some sort of bones and muscles to do it, or is courage healthy for everybody?
Yes. Do you want to answer that, or should we?
Let's throw that into the rather than me being the sage thing. Let's throw it open to discussion.
Well, there was somebody there, yes.
I'm not part of the current fan club of whistleblowers. I think the presenters have not differentiated between social responsibility and security. Security puts everybody at risk. And when somebody is working in security, they sign a document of confidentiality or whatever it is. I have no idea what they sign, but they sign something. I cannot understand professor who is responsible for I can understand why he is very happy for whistleblowers, because that's his career. But he didn't differentiate between people who have a responsibility for the security of our country and of the United States. Number two, the people, Lesage and Sanders, amaze me. If they were so correct, so perfect, why didn't they give themselves up? Why did they go and hide in an embassy? Why did they exploit the publicity of investigative reporting and not do an honest job with their whistleblowing? Thank you very much.
Plenty. Let's go. Shall we wait for one or two?
Yeah, we can wait. Sure, let's hear some more.
Okay, there's somebody by the aisle here. Ivan.
I could make a comment to the gentleman who just asked these questions.
Good.
In the German army, or in any army, in fact, I think, even in the US army, I think people give an oath to the flag or to the state or, you know, any single soldier in the German army had to give an oath to Adolf Hitler. But there were soldiers who did break this oath, suffered badly about it, over it, and were prosecuted and killed. But they did. And rightly so.
There were one or two people on the aisle here, I think, were there? Oh, yes.
And I'd like to ask Gavin, do you see future mileage in protective legislation for whistleblowers in the United Kingdom?
Is there somebody here? Yes, Kim.
Hi, I'm Kim Holt. I'm the baby pee whistleblower. I just wanted to say that having founded Patients First, which is a support group for NHS whistleblowers, and we've heard a lot of case studies, our approach is to try and build resilience within the frontline professionals, and I think partly by raising awareness about what goes on. All of the case studies that we look at people, I mean, I'm now conducting some research, actually, myself, through the Tavistock, which is a very helpful organisation to me personally in understanding what goes on. Pretty much all of us, we're brought up with our very strong professional guidance that we should raise concerns when we see issues related to patient safety. And most of us, when we do that, we expect that they'll be heard and addressed. And most of us who have got into trouble have been completely shocked by the response of the organisation. So I totally agree that a lot of it is to do with the organisation dynamics. There's something dysfunctional. It could be within the whole organisation. It could be within the team. That's what we're finding. You can have hospitals such as MissStaffs, for example, which there are parts of MissStaffs, apparently, which function very well, but there are some very dysfunctional units within MissStaffs, particularly the A&E department. And they victimised one whistleblower very severely. She was so scared to go into the car park, etc. So I think there's a lot about the dynamics within the organisation and the group. And so what we're trying to do is raise awareness generally and do training for frontline professionals. In fact, recently I spoke to a whole load of trainee doctors just to raise their awareness. If you're working in a team or department where it doesn't seem to be that welcome to say something, be careful. Don't, you know, just think about it. Seek out some allies, seek out some support. Maybe take a bit of advice. Maybe to speak to people like us about how to raise concerns safely. It's possible to survive. It is possible to hold on to your job. It is possible to maintain your mental health. But it is extremely difficult. And, you know, as a whistleblowing support group, we are dealing with a lot of traumatised people. And it's very sad that this is going on in our society today, and it does need to be sorted out.
Can I suggest that we have some comments from our speakers before there are too many thoughts added. I'm very encouraged that people are interested in the topic.
You go first about the difference between social responsibility and security. I struggle with that one.
Well, there's no. It's not a harsh black and white criteria. This is the question that was raised about how aren't we responding poorly to our security concerns by questions of openness and transparency. This is usually the dichotomy that's been suggested. Cheney, for example, says that anybody who believes in total transparency, or huge transparency, if you will, is a traitor. Because they say it's an ideological diversion from your support for your country. That's the kind of argument that you hear. I mean, most of us don't accept that argument, because we understand, I think, when you've been in journalism of this kind for a long time, you realize that what they're really worried about is embarrassment. It's not the substance of security concerns. I mean, when Julian Assange first came out with the Iraq war logs, we were told by a panoply of generals that there was going to be blood on the hands of every single journalist who printed this material, that this was done at the enormous expense of serving soldiers, serving their country and all that. Of course, it turned out to be total nonsense. Not one person was ever hurt, let alone killed, by any of these disclosures. And we're talking about no small amount of disclosures. In one case, 348,000 documents, and not one person was hurt or killed or anything. So, in a sense, you have to look, I think, beyond the claims made by the adversaries of free speech and look at the reasons why they say these things. And the real reason is to prevent the truth of what they do from getting out. You probably wouldn't agree with that. But if you're involved in mass murder as a business, then you have a lot to cover up. And you get very bloody angry when people start exposing what you've done. And I think that's the truth of it. And we can have all sorts of pristine arguments about how many angels can dance on an opaque or transparent document. But the truth is that we want as much transparency the central reason. The reason why we want transparency is because we know have some sense of what's going on. And it isn't very good. And the reason why so many of us are angry as journalists is because we have a sense of what's going on. We see the bodies coming back, the mass murder, the torture, the Abu Ghraibs, all the rest of it. And I don't think that should be kept quiet. I think that should be shouted from the rooftops.
Do you want to come back on that?
Please.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Hang on, here we go.
I must condone.
Just a moment, wait for the microphone.
Maybe say who you are as well, because it's nice to know, because you're a whistleblower, aren't you?
actually find out about whatever happened to them. They simply don't come back. That's called secret police, and it is branded as security. The other aspect of that is the use of mercenaries. It's now the case that there are quoted companies in America whose business is marketed on the American Stock Exchange of security. Those people are mercenaries, and they're supplied from one country to another for money. It is widely recognized that wars happen because of the commercial and vested interests. And a big chunk of that is the sale of these mercenaries. That cannot be right. And therefore, in talking about security and having to protect security, Gavin's point is correct, which is that you have to understand what it is that you're seeking to protect, as opposed to saying, because it's security, it must be good. It's happened that for a lot of years I've run a business which has been X-rated. I'm security cleared. I'm trained by the Ministry of Defence in delivering secure services and in running that sort of an organisation. And the rules are perfectly clear. They're not irrational. And they simply say that if you need to protect data, then you've got to be rather careful how it's accessed, and if you need to protect it from going from A to B, you make sure there's a gap between A and B so people can't get in the middle. So there's a fundamental difference between being careful to protect something and actually using the word security to mean I don't really want you to know or to ask the order. Therefore, those who need to be heard on that subject are the ones who've had people who've disappeared and really don't know what's happened. Oh.
Thank you.
Say it's noise, what's happening is science. Science is good. So in the past, the church and in Islam, the mosques and whatever, they just prevented people from knowing. They said, no, it's better for you, it's more secure that I know as a priest and you don't know anything else. Just pray. But now we found out science is better because then we know what's happening. For example, the WikiLeaks videos of helicopters shooting down on people walking, and sometimes journalists got, you know, parted in pieces by it. When I saw it, I was definitely shocked, although I knew such thing happened. But I'm still, maybe many people they will think I'm a vicious guy, but actually I supported going into the Middle East with militarily, because we needed to defend ourselves, but the way it was done, not very good. But I tell Iranians now, when they say, oh, we are just waiting for U.S. to help us, I have heard that coming out of Iran by the president, travel back and forth. I tell them, is it what you want? Being shot at from the air by a helicopter because American young soldiers don't want to die anymore for you. You need to rise up yourself. And that video is helping me to tell them they need to be courageous doing something themselves. So it's the knowledge of the crimes actually helps me to prevent some crime, I hope. And also to prevent the crime of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Iran, to make people energized and to wake up.
Ivan, behind you.
It's deeper. It obviously is often
Can you hold the microphone up a bit?
It's got a lot more to do with something like the information is power, and losing that information in any way at all is losing face in a very... Right. Yes. We're far more akin to the stereotype we used to have of the Japanese losing face, that things fall on their sword and so on. But in our society, there is very much that we mustn't look stupid at any cost.
My name's Ian Tapton. I'm a banking whistleblower, Lloyds TSB. I'm also involved with Gavin's organisation, Whistleblowers UK. I'll give you the website address. It's whistleblowersuk.org. So we'll be interested to see how many people visit the website to see if there is a genuine interest in whistleblowers in this room. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, one question. Can I just...
Yes, yes. Yes. One person here. Okay. Go.
Altogether, I have wondered for a long time, and in connection to your self-questioning, would you have had the courage to speak up? Why isn't there enough or an avalanche of people speaking out anonymously, and should there not be a facility for such flow of information to be actualized, researched, and then publicized?
Perhaps I could say something about that. I think it's a very good question, because there are a lot of people who, for excellent reasons, don't want to be known and have the ghastly effects on their family of saying something they know will cause huge trouble. Now, that's how WikiLeaks started. And WikiLeaks started because Assange is a brilliant programmer and computer guy, and he figured out, which is how I got to know him, that there was a way of using special software tools to construct a website that your entry into it to posit some information could be made very secure. And he did that. No one has ever been caught in his website, or in the WikiLeaks website, ever. Poor Bradley Manning made the mistake of talking to a friend, he thought, and that was recorded and he was turned in. But those who submitted to a secure, what we call a Dropbox, have never had a real problem. And I would suggest that anybody who wants to do that should look around for various Dropboxes now, including WikiLeaks. Because you're very safe if you do exactly what they say, which is quite a little bit complicated, but you can do it. So if you've got information, you have to understand that the most critical part of it, I won't go into all that in detail, but is the first minute when you contact a website or by phoning somebody, the first minute is critical. Because at that point, the police know, or the corporation knows, or whoever it is that's worried about you, knows that you've made a contact. So you want to find out very carefully by doing a bit of research, and I'm happy to talk to anybody here who wants to know how to do that. There are some simple ways of doing it to protect yourself. But that first minute is critical. But once you've got that first minute down, go for it. You know, you can put up anything you want. You can put up 1,000 pages, as indeed is being done as we speak. So... It does work. And there are lots of WikiLeaks now. They're not just one. There's 38 of them all around the world. Even Appalachian coal miners have the Appalachian Coal WikiLeaks. I mean, the strangest places you could ever imagine. But they're effective and they work. Incidentally, the New Yorker magazine, which publishes a lot of very good journalism, has its own Dropbox now that I'm told is very strong so far. So I would raise that for anybody who's looking for a place. Nobody will know who you are or where you've come from.
Okay, there's somebody got the microphone there? Oh, yeah.
Hello, I just want to make two very brief points. One is I came across a very good book about Nazi Germany, written by a professor of German, not Jewish, with no particular axe to grind, in fact, very in a difficult position herself, about a middle functionary in the Nazi civil service. I'm not going to go anymore. I recommend it
to you to read, and I hope you put this on the website.
What's the name of the book?
What's it? It's called A Small Town Near Auschwitz, and it's by Professor Mary Fulbrook, who's a professor of German at UCL. And it's a scholarly work, and it analyzes the conflicts that somebody in that sort of situation has to go through. And I think that's well worth looking at. Yeah. The second thing is, you haven't mentioned at all the whole idea about people getting employment payoffs subject to their not making any disclosure. I'd like you to talk about that.
Yeah.
And the last thing is, I asked you to ask the audience how many people here... How many people here have, in the course of their careers and lives, been in a position where they felt that they really should be whistleblowing, but for some reason or other they couldn't, or they shouldn't, or they wouldn't do so? And I've certainly been in that position many times. I mean, I'm a forensic accountant, so I come up with all sorts of stuff.
We must speak.
Let me just tell you that I've come to the end of my career, really, and I don't have enough money for anybody to sue me. And as you said, this is a position of great strength and ease of conscience.
Yeah.
I can say whatever I damn well like, and
great,
I probably will.
The mortgage has been paid. I'm coming out.
There's someone there, yes, with the microphone, and somebody on... Yes,
hello. Maybe this speaks to the last question. Just to add a bit of philosophical and psychoanalytical lightness to it, the parable of the emperor's new clothes...
Yeah, absolutely.
...has...
that wasn't my paper.
The social disclosure... And I won't use the word courage here, or responsibility. It's made by a child. And what is it that we lose along this pathway towards mortgages, security, and all these important things that disables the ability to just state simple, self-evident truths?
Yeah,
nice one.
Thank you. And...
thanks. This is about... I want to talk about the anonymous reporting. In the NHS, the whole point about raising concerns is that... the reason is that you're trying to prevent medical error. And we should be doing it on a regular basis. It's something that we should be doing. You know, it's low-level, early warning signs, etc. And it's something that we're encouraged to do. Much of the trauma that I've observed in some of the people that I've spoken to, they have been traumatised after the first raising of the concern. So they haven't gone to the press, they haven't gone through all the escalation. One very good example is of a nurse who was worried about the care of her patients on the ward when she was off duty. And she phoned the ward to make sure that this particular patient had had some treatment or some management that she was worried that may be forgotten. And she was berated by the ward manager and asked to come into the ward on her day off. She mistakenly went innocently, and there maybe is an innocence about many of us. We're maybe a bit naive. I was certainly quite naive. She went in on a day off, and he took her in the office and shouted at her for 2 hours. She's got post-traumatic stress. She suffered incredibly. She thought about suicide. That was the single episode that she experienced. She has actually gone back to work with a lot of support from us. And what I'm finding is that the people that we do manage to get back into their jobs, they gain strength, huge amount of strength from getting back in. But it needs a lot of support. So the anonymous reporting is something that has been used in the past within the health service. Public Concern at Work did run an anonymous phone line. Most of their calls were from the health service professionals. They lost the contract, and it was then run by MenCap. Basically, when you phone them up, they tell you where you can raise concerns. They tell you, first of all, you go to your line manager, then you can go to the NETS manager, then you go to the chief exec, then you go to CQC, etc. So they tell you all the various places you can go, which we now know none of these places are places that will independently investigate or support whistleblowers if you're in an organisation which is dysfunctional and doesn't want to hear. So that's what we now know, and that's the information that more people out there now understand. And Scotland recently set up an anonymous reporting line, and they asked us to give them some advice, and we actually said, well, the problem with it is that in the health service, the whole point about raising concerns is to try and prevent mistakes, medical error, etc. And how do you investigate a concern if you don't know where it's come from? And how do you go and talk to those people? And how, when you go and talk to those people, do you give them the confidence that they will not suffer detriment or bullying? The main problem we have in the NHS is bullying. You know, how do you protect them from bullying within that organisation? If it's an organisation that's failing, how will you protect them? And basically what the Scottish Government currently are doing is returning the concern back to the employer who is possibly already bullied and victimised many of their staff. And, you know, this is the issue that we've got at the moment. There's nowhere external that's independent. So it's very, very complex. Much of the trauma happens on day one, and then it's too late, and people become very unwell.
Okay, thank you. There's somebody there.
It's in the microphone.
I worked in Harrogate 25 years ago as a health officer. And during my training, I was always taught to be accountable. Accountable for what? I never knew. But actually, accountability is something, as a professional, you're always taught. But actually, there's nowhere to go when you've got your concern. So you're accountable for your action. You're in a very privileged position. You have literally sometimes nowhere to go. So that was 25 years ago when I was in Harrogate with the same problems. It's changing.
I've spent a lot of the last 25 years working as a psychotherapist with victims of torture and political violence. And part of that work was trying to understand something about how those situations developed, how the torture and the political violence came about. I eventually found myself in some trouble for saying too much of what I thought about the way in which the human rights organisation in which I was employed actually treated its own staff and upheld or failed to uphold human rights within its own walls.
Yeah.
I've subsequently set up an organisation called the Centre for Psychotherapy and Human Rights to try to pursue these twin concerns of providing therapy for the victims and understanding something about the causes. And what comes out of that very quickly is that the causes are very much closer to home than is readily acknowledged. You know, what's going on in the Eastern Congo goes all the way back to the business interests in London.
Yes,
and so on. There's a whole complicated global web within which these events take place. And the society in which we live is as you said so eloquently, far more managed, far more controlled than we're mostly aware. And you know, you said at the beginning, Bob, that you know what we've been told might be difficult to listen to. But I found it an enormous relief and very encouraging to hear the true state of affairs outlined and explained so clearly and so forcefully, in a way, and to hear the comments that you made, David, about the conservatism that exists within the psychoanalytic and the psychotherapeutic community, which is the very community that should be asking questions about how information is managed, how our emotions are manipulated, how political allegiances are created and constructed through a whole media and corporate management system, which is what we're struggling with.
Do you want to say more about the fact that
thank you. That's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
Thanks. I've worked for 28 years in the NHS, and I think I'd like to hear the speaker say a bit more about what's going on in society, not just in the institutions. Because if you are to survive in the public services at the moment, you have to double speak and double think every single day. You're probably aware as an audience that we've just cut 20 billion from the NHS over the last 3 years, and we're about to cut another 20 billion, yet the rhetoric is that we're improving quality. You've all heard about the number of old people coming into A&E, and we wonder why. Well, there's no wonder why.
Yeah.
It's because there's no services out there to protect them in the community.
Yeah.
And yet, society is being fed this information. The NHS is protected, and we are improving quality. So I think it's a bit difficult to know where exactly do you go as a whistleblower when you work in a situation like that from day to day, and the public seem to believe what they're fed.
Do you want to reply? I totally agree. And I work with people in the NHS, psychiatrists who are depressed and breaking down. They haven't got they're hot desking. They haven't got any mental space to think about things. They're part of a market economy, and sick people don't fit into a market economy. And that's why the NHS is under attack. You know, it's the last bit of our welfare state. It's being destroyed, you know, because I think it's not cost effective to be ill. You know, to have problems. Unless you're a psychoanalyst. and that's really true. I mean, it's very funny in psychiatry. The largest growing part of psychiatry is forensic. Okay, why? Because if you're left and abandoned and neglected for long enough, you'll hit somebody. Okay, if you're just going quietly mad on your own and feel suicidal, you don't get taken any notice of. And so forensic psychiatry is growing because you have to deal with people who act violently. I think that's being repeated on a societal level as well.
I could say something about this question of law and protection. Just a brief comment that someone asked about whether there's legal protection in a sense and whether organizations are helpful in that way. And I wanted to cast another negative smirch off.
Your therapy afterwards. There'll be a phone number to ring.
That's right. Exactly, because sadly there is a law, or there are a collection of legislative functions and designed in theory to protect whistleblowers, but which provide very little substantive protection. And most whistleblowers are very angry at the kind of false hopes that are raised, because you think there's going to be an institution of protection, some kind of legal framework to give you some support, and in fact it's often the opposite. The Public Concern at Work group, which has done some interesting things occasionally, they were the generators of that law. And that law effectively says, stay within your organization, more or less. Don't go outside. And it asks you to get involved in long, complicated ombudsman procedures and stuff, which is deeply stifling. And by the time you got out of that 3 years later, you're bankrupt, depressed, and ready for another struggle somewhere else. I think the trouble is we need to rewrite the law completely. And the law has to be restructured and re-researched and put together properly using the best examples we have from Sweden, the United States, and other places. Well, there is some protection, and we can actually do that, and that's part of the agenda of what we want to do.
I think that's quite important. There are good models in other countries
for
that.
Chap at the back, there's your waiting for ages.
We're getting towards the end of time, so if anybody wants to say the last word,
yes, go on, last word.
Get it in. We'll have only one or two more comments.
I hope I don't sound too esoteric. I find it a very interesting discussion.
Lift the microphone.
A number of anecdotes for evening. Obviously dealing with human rights and with, very serious problems. I'm interested in some ways, I suppose, on more psychological side, in the sense of I came this evening because I noticed personally 5 years ago when I went to a meeting, meetings used to be about discussions. I've noticed now in the last 5 years, since then, that meetings now are a delivery of information and there is no discussion.
Right.
It used to also be once upon a time that you then had a discussion outside of the organization with your peers or colleagues. And then you went back and it was put on the agenda, and that was the way it was done. It is now developed that basically you cannot do that because obviously now most contracts with professionals read that you're not allowed to do this because you're talking about an institution, you might actually wreck the reputation of the institution. So my interest is, in the erosion of language in ICT, that basically it's been exacerbated, obviously, by the very quick development of the ICT, the erosion of these organizations, and all of it has to do usually with money. But at the same time, I'm fascinated because I find in 2013, we no longer have a precise enough language to discuss the problem. And that really is what fascinates me, that we've drifted into this sort of mass psychology, and we can't even discuss it because we don't have any language to discuss it.
Thank you. I'm going... I'm going to ask the two speakers if they want to say a fine... Quickly.
My question, orange, is it good for health? Or is it that I think it's good for health? But do you have any...
Do you want to answer that?
Well, it's getting to splitting, isn't it? I think it takes enormous courage, and I think one has to think. There's two pieces of advice. If you know somebody's going to whistleblow, try to persuade them not to as much as one possibly can, okay? if they're absolutely dedicated to doing it, give them all the support you can, okay? And I don't think it's about psychological personalities of having courage and not having courage. I think some people just have to tell the truth. And I think it's getting more and more difficult in our society. The sort of mental space we have is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Therapies now become IAPT, which is sort of six sessions. I call it anorexic therapy. Okay. I was at a first meeting the other day, and a patient was described as a product.
Yes.
Okay.
A product.
A product. Okay. I didn't realise I'd said that, so I came home. Or I did. Kept quiet.
Okay. Any last words? Somebody's got their arm up there. Be very brief, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the people I've seen with children who've lost their families and their wives do say, was it worth it? Okay, it was worth it for society, but their own little microcosm of society has been destroyed. You know? And was it worth it? You know?
Sorry, that needs to be qualified.
Good, good.
The instance of the parent,
yeah,
who tells the truth, is the making of the child. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I think you should finish that.
Do you want to say a last comment, David?
I'll say one thing. It actually supports David, but it's a different angle. That what is consistent with what we know about whistleblowers is that courage is contagious.
Right.
It's genuinely contagious. And I would urge all of you to get contagious.
What I like is, as a psychoanalyst, that we're actually bringing politics back into psychology and mental health. And it's actually in the Freud Museum. Freud was a whistleblower. It's good. Anyway.
Can I then finally thank Ivan Ward and the Freud Museum and the team. Thank you all for coming and joining in so enthusiastically with the discussion. Thank you, Gavin. Thank you.